The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 26, 2014 issue of The Week magazine. As usual, we start with the main stories and how they were covered. The NFL's growing domestic violence scandal. What happened? The National Football League went into damage control mode this week in response to increasing outrage over its handling of domestic violence incidents involving its players. Running back Adrian Peterson was deactivated by the Minnesota Vikings after he was indicted for allegedly whooping his 4-year-old son with a leafless tree branch, resulting in open wounds on the boy's back, legs, and genitals. Peterson's indictment came amid growing furor over the league's treatment of players accused of domestic abuse, which began 2 weeks ago with a video that showed Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice knocking out his then-fiancée. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell originally suspended Rice for just 2 games, but when the video caused a national uproar, he suspended him indefinitely. 2 other players recently accused of attacks on their girlfriends, Greg Hardy of the Carolina Panthers and Ray McDonald of the San Francisco 49ers, were allowed to play this season, though Hardy this week took a leave of absence. Another player, Jonathan Dwyer of the Arizona Cardinals, was charged with domestic violence this week. With women's groups calling on Goodell to be fired, the commissioner appointed former FBI head Robert Mueller to lead an investigation into the league's handling of the Rice incident. Goodell also announced the formation of a 4-woman panel to oversee the league's domestic abuse policies. Several major sponsors, including Visa, McDonald's, and Nike, expressed concern with the league's handling of abuse cases. Anheuser-Busch, maker of Budweiser, said it was disappointed and increasingly concerned by the recent incidents that have overshadowed the NFL season. What the editorial said: if the league cares about its credibility, said the New York Times, Mueller's report must be thorough and convincing. The NFL's handling of this crisis, so far personified by Mr. Goodell's stumbling behavior, has done little to offset the belief that the league's main priority is to protect its $9 billion in annual revenue, even at the expense of protecting victims of domestic abuse. Goodell's utter failure to act on violent behavior by players is a disgrace, said the New York Daily Times. The New York Daily News. Yes, he suspended Rice indefinitely, but only after the video's release forced his hand. The commissioner did nothing when Hardy was convicted of brutally throwing his girlfriend into a bathtub and onto a couch full of guns and threatening to kill her. Goodell has never provided clear and consistent rules about player conduct and is now merely trying to appease a disgusted fan base. What the columnist said: the reality is that as long as the NFL keeps printing money, said Laura Chapin in USNews.com, it will treat domestic abuse and child beating as mere public relations problems to be smoothed over. The only way to change the league's culture is to hit it in the wallet through boycotts, pulling advertising, and pressuring Congress to end the central NFL organization's tax-exempt status. The NFL is simply too big to fail, said Kevin Clark in the Wall Street Journal. The league effectively runs the television industry, providing massive audiences and revenue that have kept broadcast networks afloat. The advertising industry spends $3 billion a year on NFL games. So many companies, in fact, cling to the NFL and its fan base as if it were a lifeboat that the league will have plenty of support as it weathers this storm. The NFL is not too big to fail, said Max Vaccaro in the New York Post. Boxing was once untouchable, too, selling out stadiums and commanding worldwide attention. But the sport's corruption, ugliness, and savagery caught up with it, and boxing is now an afterthought. For decades, football has occupied a sacred space in American life, said Andrew O'Hare in Salon.com. But the domestic abuse scandal is a reminder that football also represents American masculinity in its most toxic form. Last week, the NFL had to admit in a legal filing that nearly one-third of NFL players will suffer dementia, depression, and other disabling cognitive problems from years of head battering. This is a game that is literally killing the men who play it. And over the long haul, its inherent brutality poses a real threat to its existence. The controversy of the week, attacking ISIS. Why not call it war? President Obama last week declared war on the murderous Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. Sort of. Obama never used the word war, calling his plan for airstrikes against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, coupled with ground operations by our regional allies, a counterterrorism campaign. After critics assailed Obama's evasion, Press Secretary Josh Earnest admitted that, yes, we're at war with ISIS in the same way we're at war with Al-Qaeda and its affiliates around the world. Obama's discomfort with calling war war is understandable, said Ian Tuttle in NationalReview.com. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize on the strength of his rhetoric about international cooperation, and he sold himself to the American people as a cerebral professor who'd play chess with other nations, not rely on the crude instrument of war. Inconveniently, however, ISIS's butchers recently beheaded two captured Americans and are definitely at war with us. Conservatives may crave the muscular rhetoric of war, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post, but Obama has good reason to avoid that word. The more Obama can make this sound like a small-scale multinational police action, rather than yet another massive American-led war on two Muslim nations, the easier it will be to get the vital support of Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and our other allies in the region. Obama has showed wisdom, not weakness, in proceeding cautiously and incrementally against the ISIS threat, said Yishai Schwartz in NewRepublic.com. He held back on committing U.S. air power until the Iraqi government forced out its divisive prime minister and then waited for international outrage against ISIS to gather before announcing he'd attack the terrorist army's Syrian strongholds. When the president describes our military actions in Iraq and Syria as a fluid, ongoing counterterrorism operation, he's being entirely accurate. But those actions may be illegal, said Eli Lake in thedailybeast.com. Congress alone has the power to campaign against ISIS, is covered by the authorization for the U.S. of military, by the authorization for the use of military force passed by Congress in 2001, which gave the president broad powers to attack Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. But ISIS has nothing to do with 9/11, and Al-Qaeda has severed all ties with it. Obama may be rightly frustrated by his dealings with Congress, said Bruce Ackerman in NYTimes.com, but that doesn't justify his astonishing defiance of the Constitution and the law in launching an unauthorized war. Nothing attempted by George W. Bush remotely compares in imperial hubris. Congress deserves a full share of the blame, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. If members of the House and Senate support the ISIS battle plan the president has laid out, as most of them say they do, they should vote to give Obama the authorization he needs. They don't need to wait for him to ask nicely. Don't hold your breath, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Members of Congress don't want to risk going on record in support of the fight against ISIS so that if it goes badly, they can turn around and criticize Obama for screwing it up. So as the U.S. begins a campaign against ISIS's barbaric army that it admits may last three or more years, President Obama rummages around his desk drawers, searching for a legal basis to commit American forces abroad, while Congress mumbles and looks at its shoes. What a pathetic way to start a war. And the good week, bad week section. It was a good week for sniffing your date. After scientists asked volunteers to rate sweat samples from 21 people whose political beliefs were either strongly liberal or strongly conservative and discovered that people much prefer the body odor of those with a similar ideology. It was a good week for having a steady hand after an Australian veterinary surgeon successfully removed a brain tumor from a 10-year-old pet goldfish for a fee of $180. Dr. Tristan Rich said the fish, George, was beloved by his owner and is now swimming happily in the pond. It was a good week for Matthew Kelly, a 12-year-old Louisiana boy who survived an attack by a 10-foot-long alligator by prying his leg free from the giant reptile's maw. "All I know," said Kelly's father, Scott, "is he's the luckiest boy I know." It was a bad week for going off script after a horrified Welsh mom was forced to take away her child's talking Barbie doll when it began singing, "What the F?" "We just told her the doll had been bad," said Talina Evans, "and had to go. Mattel is now investigating." It was a bad week for concealed carry after a Utah elementary school teacher was injured when the handgun she legally carries at school accidentally went off in the bathroom, shattering a toilet and injuring her leg. And it was a bad week for enthusiastic celebrations after a wedding party at a Buffalo Country Club erupted into a brawl that saw more than 100 guests exchanging blows and required cops from 7 police departments to break it up. "There was blood everywhere," said a witness. "There were holes punched in the walls." And only in America, the federal program that supplies police departments with surplus military equipment has also been sending high-powered rifles and armored vehicles to public schools. Under the program, school districts have been outfitted with Humvees, M16 rifles, and grenade launchers. A Utah school district spokesman said officials sought the weapons because it would be irresponsible to send our officers into an active shooter situation with just a handgun. On the briefing page, California's epic drought. The parched Golden State is experiencing one of the most severe water crises in its history. How bad is the drought? By many measures, it's the worst in California since record-keeping began in 1895. At least 82% of the Golden State is now in a state of either extreme or exceptional drought, and experts are considering adding a new top level to that scale to reflect the unprecedented lack of available water. As California's lakes and streams have shriveled up and wildfires have raged across the state, some towns have been left entirely without water. In August, officials in East Porterville gave out 15,000 gallons of bottled water to residents who'd opened their taps to find a trickle of dirt running out of the faucet. California's farmers, who produce almost 70% of the country's top 25 fruits, nuts, and vegetables, have been forced to rip many of their plants from the parched land and are likely to cut 17,000 agricultural jobs. It is an unparalleled crisis, said Jeffrey Sutton, an irrigation official in the western Sacramento Valley. What's causing the drought? Nearly three-quarters of California's fresh water comes from the Sierra Nevada snowpack, which replenishes the state's rivers and lakes as it melts during the spring. But over the past two winters, a mass of high-pressure air has blocked Pacific winter storms from reaching those mountains, reducing the snowpack to just 20% of its average. Throughout the state, rainfall has been just 42 to 75% of normal since 2011. It's unknown whether climate change is playing a direct role in the precipitation problem, but many climatologists do believe that global warming may be exacerbating the drought. The first half of 2014 was the hottest on California record, with an average temperature 4.6 degrees Fahrenheit above the norm, and the sizzling temperatures have evaporated any scarce moisture left in the ground. How are Californians coping? California's Water Resources Control Board now imposes a $500 a day fine on people who overwater their lawns or wash their cars without a water-saving nozzle on the hose. Local jurisdictions are also imposing restrictions. Los Angeles limits lawn watering to three times a week. But the biggest burden has fallen on the state's farmers, who use 80% of California's water. Some have been forced to buy some of their fellow farmers' allocations at high prices, while others, like Sean Coburn, are ripping out their tomato and pomegranate crops to save the water for trees and vines that can't be fallowed in the short term, like avocados. "This year I'm going to watch stuff die," said Coburn. The majority of farmers, though, are resorting to groundwater to save their crops. How does the process work? How does that process work? The drought has prompted farmers to race to drill wells into the Central Valley's aquifers and access the underground water reserves. "He with the biggest pump or deepest straw wins," said Felicia Marcus, chair of the state's water board. But though this groundwater will replace about three-quarters of the current deficit from rivers and streams, pumping is certainly not a sustainable solution to the crisis. Sucking water out of aquifers has caused the ground to compact and sink almost a foot a year in some regions of the San Joaquin Valley, causing $1.3 billion of infrastructure damage to roads, bridges, and pipelines. Worse, these depleted aquifers can take decades to replenish. Aware that the drought is likely to continue, California's lawmakers are seeking longer-term solutions. What's being discussed? In November's elections, voters will decide whether to approve Prop 1, an emergency $7.5 billion water bond that would expand the state's reservoirs. California lawmakers have already passed a historic bill that would regulate groundwater for the first time in state history. The controversial legislation, which awaits signature of Governor Jerry Brown, was largely supported by the state's urban residents, some of whom resent sharing scarce resources with farmers of produce that requires a lot of water, such as almonds. Farming communities are just as angry, blaming lawmakers for allowing urban development in some of the state's driest regions and claiming that the groundwater is part of their property. When you're legislated out of something that's been in your family for generations, it's hard to stomach, said rancher Gavin Iacono. When will the crisis be over? The forecast doesn't look good. Indeed, some experts fear that this California drought, which is part of a wider drought across the West that's lasted for 14 years, could represent the beginning of a historic mega drought, a decades-long period of extreme dryness that geological studies show occurs in the region every 400 to 600 years. If this current drought isn't the start of a mega drought, one is probably on the way. A new Cornell University study estimates a 20 to 50% chance of a 35-year mega drought by the century's end. Nonetheless, California's population is expected to grow to 50 million by 2050, making the effects of that potential water crisis even more severe. The current drought is a glimpse of things to come, said the Cornell Studies lead author Tony Ault. It's a preview of our future. The state's thirstiest nut. Almonds are now the most eaten nut in the United States, with people across the nation consuming 10 times the amount they did in 1965. But few people realize the cost that goes into their production. In California, where 82% of the world's almonds are produced, it takes a whopping 1.1 gallons of water to produce a single kernel. Indeed, the water used by almond farmers could supply 75% of California's population. But with global business booming, especially in China, almond farmers have continued to plant trees in spite of the drought, in the process causing water to be diverted from the Klamath River, threatening the salmon that feed the local Yukon tribe. Not only are they asking the Native Americans to sacrifice their culture, says Yurok member Frankie Myers, but we're doing it so we can sell almonds to the Chinese. Moving on to the best columns, we'll take two from the U.S. this week. The first comes from David Harsanyi at thefederalist.com. It's titled, What We Got in Return for Warming. Green purists will never admit it, but global warming was worth it, said David Harsanyi. Eco-extremists in the sustainability movement are now arguing that the Industrial Revolution was a terrible mistake, and we'd all be better off if we'd never started burning fossil fuels, manufactured cars and other consumer goods, or abandoned 17th century squalor for civilization. But even if you accept climate change as a major threat today, it's perverse to believe that man's greatest economic achievements were a historical mistake. Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, billions of people enjoy a far higher standard of living and enjoy far longer lives. Worldwide life expectancy more than doubled from 1750 to 2007. Most people no longer spend their lives trying to avoid starvation, and there is widespread access to wondrous consumer goods, services, housing, and health care. In recent decades, mankind has cleaned up some of its population pollution, and the world is cleaner, healthier, and livable. So, would it have been better for humanity to wallow in a miserable pre-industrial age or pay the price of global warming? I think the latter, and I think we'd do it again. From Emily Shire at thedailybeast.com, Why Women Choose Abortions. Wendy Davis has made a courageous admission, said Emily Shire. In her new book, the pro-choice Texas state senator and Democratic gubernatorial candidate reveals she had two abortions, one to terminate a life-threatening ectopic pregnancy, and the other because tests revealed her fetus had severe brain abnormalities. The mother of two wanted that baby, and you have to be pretty heartless not to be touched by her wrenching account. But most abortions do not fit into the publicly acceptable category of a tortured, loving mother acting out of almost pure medical necessity. Nearly 30% of American women have abortions, and the vast majority do so in the first trimester for personal, not medical reasons. They did not intend to get pregnant and aren't ready to be a mother or add another child to their responsibilities. Many women who make this decision are relieved, not filled with doubt or remorse. It's for these women, too, that we must have the choice in this country. Until the bad abortion stories are just as acceptable as Wendy Davis's, pro-choice advocates have a long way to go. This column comes from Turkey. It's a how they see us. Why Turkey won't fight ISIS. Turkey's refusal to help the U.S. battle Islamist militants in Iraq and Syria is baffling, said Sendek Sidar in Radikal. President Obama has been pleading for Turkey to join the coalition, better police its borders with Syria, and stop the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria from using Turkish territory to export oil, the terrorist group's main source of funding. Yet Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has rebuffed him, saying anything we do against ISIS will endanger the 49 hostages seized in June from Turkey's consulate in Mosul, Iraq. That excuse, though, is transparently false. Turkey is a member of NATO, and if other NATO members such as the U.S. and France bomb ISIS, the group will surely retaliate against any NATO member it can reach, and that means Turkey. Erdogan has allowed the capture of 49 hostages to take our entire domestic security and foreign policy hostage as well. Let's ask why the hostages were snatched in the first place, said İhsan Yılmaz in Today's Zaman. When ISIS advanced on Mosul, Turkish authorities initially believed the terrorist would leave the consulate alone. Is that because the two were cooperating? There is certainly an ideological affinity between some radical and Islamist sections of Turkey's ruling party and ISIS. Hundreds, perhaps thousands, of Turks are fighting with ISIS, yet Erdogan has failed to follow Obama's lead in condemning the group as a perversion of Islam. That's because Erdogan is positioning himself for the post-war period, said Emre Usla, also in Today's Zaman. An Islamist himself, he has long believed that he is the chosen leader of the Islamic world against the West, and has been careful not to alienate even the most extreme Islamist movements. He has been funding any and all groups fighting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and once Assad is gone, Erdogan believes he will be able to play kingmaker in Syria. Erdogan is right to resist the false choice offered by the U.S., said Dogan Eskinat in Daily Sabah. Just because we refuse to sign on to irresponsible U.S. military involvement in the Middle East does not mean we support the terrorists. In fact, Turkey is willing to send humanitarian aid. But drone strikes, the American weapon of choice, since they keep American boots off the ground, will inevitably kill and maim hundreds of innocents. In Yemen and Somalia, such raids have given al-Qaeda affiliates the chance to recruit fighters from tribes who suffered casualties. It's a doomed strategy, and Turkey won't join it. Gone are the days when a president of the United States could declare that millions of people in their governments were either with or against America. Turkey will stand up for itself and for fellow Muslims. And the last word section. Our in-depth article this week is titled "Keeping Comedians Sane." Comedy is such a brutal business, said Christopher Gofford, that one club has an in-house psychologist. Ildiki Tabori has never stood on a stage trying to make strangers laugh, doesn't write jokes, and admits that she's not great at telling them. Trying to recount something clever she heard, she makes advance apologies. I'm not going to do it justice. But if you make a living being funny, Tabori understands the particulars of your pain better than most. For the past 3.5 years, she's been an in-house psychologist at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood. Being a comedian is truly the hardest job in the entertainment industry, Tabori says. You have a lot of late nights. You have good sets, you have bad sets. It is kind of a lonely existence at times. She knows about the constant pressure of finding gigs. The uncertainty of whether the routine that worked yesterday will work tonight. The front row drunk, ruining your set. The allure of drugs and alcohol. The hard-to-describe emptiness that attends interactions with fans who mistakenly believe they know you because they related to a joke. And the strain of watching fellow comics shoot to stratospheric success, sometimes as fresh arrivals on the scene. I do hear that a lot, Tabori says. Why is this person successful, and why am I not? Robin Williams' suicide last month was a reminder of why she's there. Club owner Jamie Masada hired Tabori after he became alarmed by the number of premature deaths in the comic world, including Richard Jenny's suicide in 2007 and Greg Giraldo's fatal overdose 3 years later. He felt the comedians needed some support from a professional, she says. He's not trained to recognize someone who's going to kill themselves, and I am. During the day, she sees patients at her West Los Angeles office. Two or three nights a week, she drives to the Sunset Strip Club around the time comedians start taking the stage. Clients follow her up a narrow staircase, past the bar and VIP lounge to a third-floor office where they sit on an old-fashioned red couch that used to belong to Groucho Marx. Clowns gape from the walls. Through the floorboards rise the muffled sounds of jokes living and dying on the stage below. Initially, people were skeptical of Dr. Tabori because, A, she's a female, B, they didn't think they needed any help, and C, how could this doctor, who never did stand-up comedy, understand them, said veteran comic Sunda Kronquist, who has been seeing her for 3 years. She says Tabori helped her get through a horrible dark time in my life, precipitated by a lawsuit by her in-laws, who were angry at her depiction of them in her act. She's hardcore, Kronquist says. You're not going to get a fluffy pillow. It's like, Sunda, you have to deal with this. A Los Angeles native and daughter of a former runner from the Hungarian Olympic team, Tabori grew up absorbing what she calls an Eastern European work ethic. As a girl, she fell in love with Johnny Carson and had pet cockatiels named Mork and Mindy. She originally wanted to be an ethnographer, to see the world and study customs, and now, I guess I am kind of an ethnographer, I study this culture. Often she stands in the back of the club watching her clients perform. It can provide clues as to what's hurting them. For years she counseled inmates at L.A. County jails and sex offenders for the State Parole Board, which is one thing she tells people when they ask how a non-comic could possibly understand a comic's pain. I don't have to live that experience to understand what's going on with them, said Tabori, 43, who is divorced with an 8-year-old daughter. I'm not bipolar, but I can work with someone who has bipolar disorder. Emotions are universal. Masada, the club owner, says he interviewed dozens of psychologists before he found Tabori. She understands comics, he said. He pays for comics' first few sessions with Tabori or another therapist who comes on alternate days. After that, they pay on a sliding scale. Tabori, who calls the gig the coolest job any psychologist can have, has seen scores of comics since Masada hired her. In a casual conversation, Tabori exudes easy cheerfulness, but she describes her approach with her patients this way. I'm not a touchy-feely earth mother. I'm the type of therapist who is going to call you on your crap. I'm going to hold you accountable. Research shows that depression and bipolar disorder are more pervasive in comics than in the general population, she says, and the lifestyle can exacerbate it. Show business is brutalizing, competition is cutthroat, and the road, where many comics make their money shuttling between stages in nowhere towns, is a lonely place. They're sitting alone in an icky, dark hotel room, and that loneliness creeps in, she says. I get a lot of calls from hotel rooms. Tabori's clientele is supposed to be a secret, of course, though it's a joke at the Laugh Factory that everyone knows who she counsels. One of them is Rajiv Satyal, 38, who's been doing comedy full-time for 8 years. He says comics often speak of the microphone as an arrow pointing right at them. The rejection is public, he says. I'll never know how good my friends are at their jobs. They're doctors or lawyers. Whereas you know how good of a stand-up I am. You can see me. When he worked in the marketing department at Procter & Gamble, he says, a coworker might inch up a rung on the corporate ladder. In comedy, your peer's success means they are rich and famous. The feeling of inadequacy is fed by the industry. Brett Riley, a 15-year comedy veteran, says he began seeing Tabori because he didn't want his infant daughter to be harmed by his free-floating anxieties about his job. This is one of those professions that is not a good career choice, said Riley, 35. You're not guaranteed anything. You're a trapeze artist without a net. For all their onstage vulnerability, comics work in a macho culture, and there's still a stigma attached to seeing a psychologist, he says. We're intellectual jocks. We're our own boss. So seeking help is not really conducive to our conquer-the-world standalone attitude. On a recent night, Riley was three jokes from finishing his 20-minute set when a woman in the audience began heckling him loudly and brazenly. His comeback included an unflattering description of the circumstances of her conception. But it gave him little satisfaction, and he spent the rest of the night apologizing to other performers and club staff, though everyone agreed she had it coming. It's a pressure cooker, he says. It's like riding a bull. You have no idea if some crazy lady is going to come out one night and start screaming at you. I don't think there's too many jobs where others can yell at you. Sometimes, Tabori says, hecklers can lead to breakthroughs in therapy. She recalls a veteran comic who called to say he'd had a terrible set. A heckler had interrupted him. Normally, he ignored hecklers, but this time he had seen red. He said, "She looked like my mother," she says. He thought he'd worked through issues with his mom. Recently, as Tabori's clients try to make sense of William's death, she's seen the initial shock giving way to something else. The anger is starting to hit, she says, recalling a comic who noted that Williams left children behind and who also felt guilty for his anger. Tabori's assistant, James Harris, 39, who is both a psychologist in training and a comic, says the suicide unnerved comics in part because Williams represented the pinnacle of talent and success in their field. It's scary because so many people think the answer to their happiness is going to be that kind of accomplishment, he says. On some level, you have to ask, what if those things don't make me happy? Tabori had been waiting for a patient at her day job when she saw the news on Facebook of William's death. She sent Masada an email saying, "Please remind the comedians I'm here." The next morning, she says, one of her comedian clients sent her an email that said, "Thanks for keeping me and my friends alive." "I have it saved and flagged," she says. "That one I'll keep forever." This was reprinted with permission from the Los Angeles Times. I'm going to pick up one of the business articles this week. It's their issue of the week, Alibaba's blockbuster IPO. For weeks, Wall Street has been working itself into a frenzy over Alibaba's potentially record-breaking IPO, said Chris Wright in Forbes.com. But as is so often the case when internet companies go public, hype can quickly become hyperbole. So what exactly does the Chinese e-commerce giant do to warrant a market value of more than $170 billion, three times bigger than General Motors? It's almost easier to list what Alibaba doesn't do, said Mark Broad in BBC.com. As China's biggest online commerce company, Alibaba owns several wildly popular and successful sites. Taobao, an eBay-like platform, Tmall, which helps retailers sell to China's booming middle class, and the flagship Alibaba, which connects Chinese manufacturers and wholesalers with consumers and companies around the world. It also owns stakes in the Chinese equivalents of PayPal, Twitter, and YouTube, and reportedly handles 80% of online retail sales in China, a market projected to be worth $713 billion by 2017. Whatever you do, don't call it the Amazon of China, said Charles Riley in CNN.com. Despite inevitable comparisons, there are huge differences in the company's business models. Compared to Amazon, Alibaba's revenue is small, but it enjoys much higher profit margins because it acts only as the middleman between shoppers and sellers, making money on advertising and product search placement, and in some cases, commissions on transactions. That's very different from Amazon, which incurs higher costs and lower profits by acting as the seller itself. And since Alibaba is poised to tap into China's rapidly expanding internet audience, it's no wonder that investors are salivating at the prospect of owning a slice. Those investors are kidding themselves, said Paul J. Lim in Money.com. Alibaba is big now, but it faces stiff competition from rival Chinese tech firms like search engine Baidu and online marketplace JD. Investors should also keep in mind that while Alibaba is listing on the New York Stock Exchange, the shares you buy won't give you any ownership stake. To get around Chinese restrictions on foreign ownership, shareholders will actually own stock in a company based in the Cayman Islands, which will receive profits that Alibaba generates in China. This may sound like a distinction without a difference, but disputes are bound to arise as foreign owners have no say in the actual operation of the underlying company. An equally big worry is the shaky Chinese economy, said William Pisek in BloombergView.com. Alibaba's success hinges on the promise that China's middle class will keep growing and spend like Americans. But as China faces a slowing economy, that's an increasingly risky bet. Alibaba's cheerleaders cite their faith in founder Jack Ma, whose improbable journey from English teacher to tech impresario is as good as it gets when it comes to made-in-China success stories. But Ma has built a near-monopoly online only because the regime in Beijing has allowed him to do so. Remember that if you buy Alibaba, you're placing your trust in much more than a 49-year-old businessman. You're really betting on an opaque political system that has a monopoly on whether he will be allowed to succeed. On the health and science page, greenhouse gases hit record high. Has Earth's biosphere reached the saturation point for carbon dioxide? New data from the World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, show greenhouse gases in the atmosphere increased at a record pace in 2013, a trend that points to potentially devastating climate change in the decades ahead. As cars, power plants, and factories continue to emit more and more CO2, the WMO says, the capacity of oceans and forests to absorb the gas is diminishing. Usually about half of the CO2 emissions winds up in trees and the seas. But last year, CO2 levels shot up nearly 400 parts per million, the highest in the history of human civilization. Scientists are especially concerned because the last time the biosphere struggled to absorb CO2, in 1998, it was blamed on the El Niño weather system. That year, global temperatures set records. In 2013, there are no obvious impacts on the biosphere, the WMO's Oksana Tarasova tells BBC.com. We don't understand if this is temporary or if it is a permanent state. It could be that the biosphere is at its limit. Marijuana's impact on teens. A huge new study has found that teenagers who smoke marijuana daily are 60% less likely to complete high school and 7 times more likely to attempt suicide. In one of the largest projects of its kind, researchers gathered data on the cannabis use of 3,725 students from Australia and New Zealand and monitored them for 7 developmental outcomes up to age 30. Controlling for various factors, including socioeconomic status, use of other drugs, and mental issues, they found clear and consistent associations between regular cannabis use and high school and college graduation rates, suicide attempts, other illicit drug use, and cannabis dependency. Significantly, they also found that the risks of negative outcomes increased with the frequency of cannabis use. The findings are timely given movement in some states in the U.S. and Latin America to decriminalize marijuana, lead author Edmund Sillins tells TheGuardian.com. Because our study has shown the potential harms of adolescent use, particularly heavy use, policymakers must be aware of this, and reform efforts should be carefully considered to protect against this. Blue whales, big comeback. Blue whale populations off the coast of California have rebounded to levels not seen since before humans began hunting them more than a century ago, research has found. Today, there are roughly 2,200 of the mammals living in the northern Pacific Ocean from Mexico to Alaska, up from around 750 in the 1930s. It was previously assumed that the pre-whaling populations likely exceeded 2,200, but researchers from the University of Washington now believe that current population is 97% as large as it was before widespread whaling became prevalent in the Pacific around 1905. For us, this is a great conservation success story, study author Cold Monahan tells the Associated Press. We caught way too many whales from this population, but when we left them alone, they recovered. While California blue whales' numbers have bounced back, the situation elsewhere in the world is less promising. The blue whale population off the coast of Chile is 10 to 20% of historical levels. In Antarctica, where there were once 240,000 of the mammals, there are fewer than 2,400. On the Talking Points page, domestic abuse, why women stay with violent men. Why did she stay, said Sarah Kaplan in WashingtonPost.com. That's the question everyone asked last week when a video emerged of Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice knocking out his then-fiancée, Janae, with a vicious punch in an elevator. How could any self-respecting woman stand by a man who'd knocked her unconscious? People wondered incredulously, let alone marry him a month later. An avalanche of answers to that judgmental question came via Twitter as thousands of domestic abuse victims explained their own reasons for remaining with a violent partner, posted under the hashtag, Why I Stayed. One tweet explained, My girls needed a father. Said another, he told me, no one will ever love you like I do. A third said, I was hit at home growing up. How was I to have learned relationships could be different? It's easy for outsiders to imagine abused women tearing off their wedding rings and building new lives, as friends and family shout, you go, girl, said Mackenzie Dawson in the New York Post. But inside the complex reality of most battered women, leaving is no simple matter. In fact, it takes an average of 7 tries for a victim to leave an abusive relationship, and that's if they leave at all. As a victim, you feel such inner toil and confusion, said Robin Givens in Time.com. When I was first knocked unconscious by my ex-husband, boxer Mike Tyson, I insisted I'd never go back. For 3 days, I stayed strong. But then you start taking his calls. Eventually, you agree to meet up. Then you have a big, giant man crying like a baby on your lap, describing how he was abused when he was younger and promising he'll never do it again. Next thing you know, you're consoling him. Some of us stay because we are financially dependent on our abusers, said Anonymous in thedailybeast.com. I was 8 weeks pregnant with my second child when my husband hit me. I had no income of my own, no bank account, no car, nowhere for my kids to live. Over time, the slapping and punching came to feel like no big thing, a necessary compromise for my kids' sake. It took me 5 more years of abuse before I worked up the courage to grab my kids and go. In the short term, leaving can sometimes make things worse, said Nicole Beverly in HuffingtonPost.com. After a particularly bad beating left me with cracked ribs, I did exactly what people say you should do. I moved out. I contacted a domestic violence resource center and filed a restraining order. But still, I wasn't safe. Enraged that he'd lost control over me, my husband began stalking me and would call me over and over and describe how he would kill me. When I had him arrested multiple times, judges gave him a lecture and let him go. In the real world, leaving an abusive partner statistically raises the likelihood of being murdered by the partner 75%. Today, my husband is in prison for aggravated stalking, but he's told his fellow inmates that he plans to kill me as soon as he gets out. I left him, but I'm still terrified. Statistics show that tens of millions of women are abused in this country, said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com. It's time for real change. Sentences for domestic abuse must be toughened and consistently enforced. Shelters for battered women and their children need greater funding. The people who run them say they must often turn victims away for lack of room. In the end, hashtag why I stayed is probably a good answer to a bad question, said Charlotte Alter in Time.com. It puts the focus and thus the blame on the victims, not on the abusers. It took me 4 years to leave my violently abusive husband, a wealthy Wall Street trader, said Leslie Morgensteiner in WashingtonPost.com. I confused pity for love and thought I could save him from his demons. So if Janae Rice stays with Ray, don't judge her or keep asking, why doesn't she just leave? Instead, let's ask why there are so many women like her and why there are so many men who think they have a right to beat up their wives and girlfriends. ISIS, is it really Islamic? Is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria not actually Islamic? It sounds like a dumb question, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. But in his speech announcing expanded military action last week, President Obama insisted that ISIS should not be viewed as an Islamic terrorist group. No religion condones the killing of innocents, he said, and the vast majority of ISIS's victims have been Muslim. Now, it's understandable that Obama wants moderate Muslims to know that the U.S. isn't going to war with Islam. We desperately need their help to defeat ISIS. But since ISIS bases its kill the infidels ethos on Islamic, as opposed to Christian, Jewish, or Buddhist scripture and teaching, isn't it fair to call it a little Islamic, or perhaps Islamic-ish? To deny that the jihadists are Islamic because they kill Muslims is like saying Stalin wasn't a communist because he killed communists. ISIS is not, nor will ever be, Islamic, said Igor Volsky and Jack Jenkins in thinkprogress.org. As a decentralized religion, Islam lacks a single religious authority. But major Muslim groups all over the world have rejected ISIS for reinventing Islam as a violent religion. The Ku Klux Klan claimed to be Christian, even as it burned crosses and hung black people from trees. But it was no more Christian than ISIS is Islamic. ISIS is less a religious phenomenon than a political one, said Robert Kuttner in HuffingtonPost.com. The barbarism of the Sunni extremist group was born of years of Sunni oppression by Shiites in Syria and Iraq. If ISIS represents Islam at all, it's a vengeful, medieval version of the religion dragged into the modern world. That doesn't make ISIS's version false, said Jerry A. Coyne in NewRepublic.com. All religions are based on sacred texts with multiple conflicting interpretations. The Quran and the Bible both have passages condoning acts abhorrent in modern secular culture. Killing children who disobey their parents, stoning adulterers to death, slaughtering non-believers and condemning them to hell. Whose faith is truer? Those who interpret these texts literally, or those who prefer a more liberal reinterpretation? Yes, ISIS is based on a strain of Islam that's barbaric. But just because we non-Muslims prefer other strains doesn't mean ISIS has no claim on the Islamic faith. If ISIS is not Islamic, then the Inquisition was not Catholic. And a few notes as we wind down. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria now pulls in more than $3 million a day from oil smuggling, human trafficking, theft, and extortion. The group controls as many as 11 oil fields in Iraq and Syria and sells a barrel of oil that would cost $100 on the open market for the black market rate of $25 to $60 a barrel. Americans work an average of 41 hours a week, compared with 38.4 in the UK, 36.9 in Germany, and 35.7 in France, according to a new study. Nearly 30% of Americans work on weekends, and 26.6% do work from home after 10 p.m. The Obama administration's deportation of undocumented immigrants has dropped 20% so far this year, from 320,167 people to 258,608. The decline primarily reflects President Obama's decision to focus on deporting those who commit crimes. Since 2008, the administration has deported 2.1 million immigrants. And we'll finish off today with a quote. When the power of love overcomes the love of power, the world will know peace. That's from Jimi Hendrix, quoted in the Pueblo, Colorado Chieftain. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.